everyone. This is episode 8 of season X of the GNU World Order. Let's start out with our fortune of the show. See what we get. Life is fraught with opportunities to keep your mouth shut. That's good advice in general. Bad advice for someone doing a podcast. Because if I kept my mouth shut, it would be a very short show. So I'm going to ignore our fortune for today and move right along into the Emacs tip of the show. There is a mode in Emacs called, I think, dir-ed. Anyway, it's a directory view mode. So it's kind of like a file manager inside of Emacs. And it's actually pretty capable. It's got a lot of cool things that you can do in it. So let's take a look.
So I'm starting Emacs in windowed mode so that you can see the screen better. There's not a whole lot to dir-ed. To launch dir-ed, you hit Alt-X, or Meta-X if you prefer, and type in the word dir-ed. And then you can tell it what directory you want to look at. The default is your home directory. And this is dir-ed. It's a little bit ugly because the font is so large, so that's more what it would look like under normal circumstances. Making it big again, though, so that you can see it. And the navigation is pretty much standard Emacs type of navigation. So Control-N, Control-P to maneuver around, or you can use shortcuts like Escape, greater than symbol to go to the end of the document, less than symbol to go to the top of the document. Pretty much standard stuff. To open a file, you just hit return, and then you've opened a file. And to switch back to dir-ed, it's again standard Emacs navigation. Control-X, B to switch a buffer, and tell it which buffer to go to. Or I could just kill this buffer, Control-X, and then K, return, and now I've closed that file. So that's kind of nice. So let's open this thing, and we'll add stuff to it. Add text to this file, and then we'll save it as, so Control X W to write the file back out, and we'll just call it deleteme.txt. So we've just sort of done a save as. Now you can kind of see here that there doesn't really seem to be the file that we just created and saved. And that's one thing that dir-ed doesn't do super great, which is kind of update itself, but that's because we're not, you know, this is the buffer as we visited it before we did anything with that file. So if we want to update the view, you can just hit G, as in go, and that updates the view, as you can see. Now we can delete this file, since it's asking us to do that, by hitting the D key for delete. Now it's marked for deletion. And if I want to execute that deletion and actually do that, I could give it the explicit command to delete. I think it's dir-ed do, yeah, delete. So now it's asking for confirmation. I say yes, I really want to do that, and now it's actually deleted and purged from the file system, which is scary, but if you have confidence in yourself, you can certainly do that. So Alt-X and then the string dir-ed and then tabbing a bunch of times gives you a pretty good view of all the different things that dir-ed can do, and there's quite a lot of it. So I'm not going to go through it all because this is supposed to be a tip, not a tutorial, but it is really useful. It's a great little tool, especially for the things where really all you want to do is maneuver around, you know, the folder that you're working in, and kind of hop around without maybe necessarily getting out of Emacs.
There you go, dir-ed mode, dir-ed, I don't know. But the cool thing about that is that you can kind of, if you get used to it, and I try to use it frequently just because it is a handy thing to have. And the main thing about it is that it prevents you from having to go out of Emacs to another terminal or or to an actual file manager, a GUI file manager, and do things. You can just stay in Emacs. And that, I mean, that, I think, above all else, that seems to be kind of like one of the things about Emacs. Like, if you launch it, you should be able to go into full screen and never leave it. That's just kind of one of the things that happens to be, I think, I doubt that it was intended to be that, but it became that. You know, it is an environment. It's a whole environment that once you're in it, you feel like, why should I ever have to leave? I'm working right now. I just want to stay in Emacs. And it excels at enabling that desire. Why bother with Linux? This is a question that I'm not asked with. I'm not asked about frequently, but it does come up on occasion. Not obviously from listener feedback or anything, but like in real life, you know, people are asking, well, why bother? It's not necessarily something that I have a good answer for in real life, because generally speaking, when someone is asking me about an operating system, if they're asking me, then usually what I find is that they're looking for a reason not to follow through with something that they're thinking of following through. It's almost like if you have to ask, you're not ready. So in some sense, I don't usually converse with people at length about, oh, this is why you should switch to Linux. Because, I mean, if they're asking, then I don't want to be that guy pushing them over the edge, because then I'm going to be the guy that they blame when they decide it's too hard for them to use or whatever. And you know, that's just me. You can have your own methodology. You know your own sort of capabilities and everything. But in terms of Linux as an operating system, and why am I so interested in it? Why do I stick with it? Why do I really think it's like so good that I run only Linux? That's kind of like the sense of some of the questions that I do get in real life. Because, I mean, people look at it and all they see is the veneer, you know? It's either this or it's that, or it looks too much like this or it looks too much like that. You know, there's all that sort of like first impression based on looks alone types of things that people say about it. They don't really understand the big deal about it. And there's a great website that I saw that has nothing to do with what I'm talking about, other than it was addressing a similar question. And I'll have to put the link in the show notes because I don't have it on hand. But he shows with very, very good command line stuff, command line tricks, exactly why he loves Linux. You know, it's a really interesting read. And it's one of those where, again, just actions speak louder than words. You can say why you love it all you want, but when you start showing people, like, this is exactly what I do with Linux, and this is why I love it, because it allows me to do these things, and see how much easier it is to do this over here than this over on this other platform. So, I mean, that's a great reason. I'm going to address it from more of a computer nerd side of things, and by computer nerd, I mean the traditional computer nerd, the guy who builds computers and tinkers with computers and takes them apart and repairs them, that kind of computer nerd. Because, I mean, there, at this point, like I addressed, I think, in episode 1 or 2, there's the maker culture, there's the hacker culture, you know, there's the geek thing. Like, geek, being a geek is a thing now. So you can't really just say, oh, for geeks, such and such. Because geeks is such a broad term at this point. But I feel like no one still really wants to lay claim to the term nerd. No one wants to be a nerd still. So maybe we can resort to that still. And so by computer nerd, I'm talking mostly about the people who the geeks go to when things go wrong. But this may apply to others as well. But that's kind of the angle I'm coming at it from. So in order to talk about this particular thing, I want to talk a little bit about life jackets, which are great things. I think you'll probably agree if you've ever been on a boat or near water. They'll save your life in some situations, usually when you fall into the water. But there are two truths about life jackets. One is that they don't do a bit of good if they're not around when you need them. And two, they work better if you don't fall into the water in the first place. Okay, those are two things that are pretty hard, I think, to argue against. They're just kind of truths that we can just take as they say, self-evident. So I'm using, as you might have guessed, the term life jacket as an analogy. And I'm talking about, of course, computers, data, and productivity. So computers are tools. They're very unique tools, but they're different. You know, they're different than something like hammers and drills, or even cars and lawnmowers, because those things, they don't retain the data or the work that you have put into them. You know, if you use a hammer and a drill to build something, that thing stands on its own. Even if you throw out the hammer and throw out the drill, you still have the fruits of your labor. A computer, on the other hand, is, you know, while you might have like a hammer and a drill out in a shed, a work shed, where you build your stuff, the computer wouldn't be a hammer or a drill. It would be, in a sense, the shed. And that's, you can see that at work if you make something on one very specific application, and then you want to go open that file. What do? Well, usually, in order to open that file, you have to have access to that application. There are exceptions, but generally speaking, broadly speaking, we can say, in order to open up the product of some application, you need that same application to then open it and continue to work on it. And that really bites people eventually, over the course of a couple of years. Because initially you do the work, maybe you print it off or you send it out or whatever, and you wash your hands of it, you're done with it. And then inevitably there's like, 3 years, 4 years pass, and you realize, I should really go back to that thing that I made that one time and kind of touch it up, brush it up for my resume or for my portfolio, or I should reuse it for this other project because that was pretty good and with a couple of modifications it could apply just as well to this thing. You know, there are often those moments when you look back at your files and you think, I actually am not done with that yet. And then in some cases, in some very bad cases, you realize that you are done with that thing because you don't have the application that created it anymore. And that gets pretty messy and pretty sad. So you really kind of almost have to retain the computer or the drive or whatever in order to access the thing that you created. So, like I say, the computer is more or less the shed and all the tools in it and the project that you built, all in one package. Now, would you ever think to yourself, hey, I think I'll build my hardware shed, my carpentry shed, on someone else's property? You probably wouldn't, because what if they went on holiday and you wanted to go work in the shed, but they've got their place locked up? Or what if they sell their land? Then there goes your shed, right? So the implication here is obvious. Like, if you don't own the shed and all the tools in it, if you don't own the shed, you don't own the tools or the projects, because it's all inside there. It's all in there. If you don't have access and ultimate control over that thing, then you stand to lose it all. That's pretty accurate, actually. I was going to try to qualify that, but it's actually that sums it up pretty well. So the question would be, for computing, is whether we own our computers or not. And I think, for me personally, I cannot fathom the idea of investing time and effort into something that someone else could take away from me at any moment. And if you think that seems, silly, you don't have to look very hard for examples. They're all over the place. Just go online, look at some forums. You will see people complaining about how something has changed and all of their work is ruined because this thing has changed. They no longer have access to this software, or the software has changed out from under them and it's completely different now. All that stuff. You'll see it all over the place. Because software vendors don't even guarantee the sanctity of your data. Like, they don't guarantee that they're going to take care of that, much less the longevity or the stability of the platform you created it on. That's just not something that you're agreeing to when you fire up an application. I don't care how much you spent on it, it's just not part of the deal. And, you know, Linux doesn't either. I mean, there's no guarantee of backwards compatibility or longevity with open source software. But it does, I mean, aside from it being open source. Because since it is open source, you can obviously take the code and make it sort of eternal on its own, just as a closed system, as a self-contained system. But aside from that, Linux as a platform does not guarantee that it is not going to change. But I will say that it tends to be very backwards compatible. In fact, the Linux kernel itself, from what I understand, I've not tried it myself, a trimmed down version of the Linux kernel can literally still run the original x86 CPU. I don't think they mean like the original actual CPU, but the original series, you know, that model of CPUs, a very trimmed down version of the Linux kernel can still drive that. I don't know if that's, like I say, I've not tried it, but that is what people are saying. So Linux puts all of that stuff into your hands. It makes sure that you have the ability to create backwards compatibility or to freeze it at a moment in time and make sure that it has longevity going forward. So all that has to do with the second point of life jackets, which is to say that they work really, really well if you don't fall into the water in the first place. Just avoid that problem, and you'll never have a problem. The other thing about all this is that if you... Well, first of all, I should say that tenant, that right there, is why companies build on Linux. You know? I mean, really, that is one of the main reasons that companies invest in Linux at all. It's obviously not because they love the community. It's not because they think we're doing a good job and they want to contribute back to us. They're doing it because they know that they can take a snapshot of whatever they are running at any point in time, and they have full access to everything. Everything. I'm talking down to the kernel level on up. They've got everything that they can take a snapshot of, fork it in any direction they want, and it's absolute security. Data security, not like, you know, security. It's a guarantee that code base belongs to you. And if you had to, in worst case scenario, you could take every bit of it and just fork it in whatever direction you have to fork it. So the other thing about life jackets is that they have to be there in order to be useful. So how many times do computer technicians go out into the world, or have people come to them more likely, to rescue a user from some situation where not just their OS is failing them, but their own understanding of computers is betraying them? You know, I mean, restricted operating systems and applications, they're designed to keep users out. That is exactly what they do that. It's not a secret. It's not something that sometimes they do gloss over it. In fact, usually they gloss over it. But it is still an explicitly stated goal. How explicit? Well, every time you install one of these applications, you actually do, as you know, you agree to a end-user license agreement. And that's explicitly saying that you're not going to, you know, abuse any of the things that you have purchased, and that you don't own any of that stuff either, and that you only have permission to run it under these certain conditions, and so on and so forth. You're not allowed to reverse engineer it, all those things. That's written into the contract. It is the contract. So they're not designed to be there for you under a no matter what kind of situation. They're pay to play, explicitly pay to play. And like I say, sometimes they do gloss over that. Generally speaking, they do. Very few times do vendors advertise that you are renting their software. You know, you're paying for the right to use their software. And if you stop paying, then you lose that right. They don't advertise that. That's not part of the marketing scheme. And a lot of times there's a lot of marketing to make sure that no one's asking that question. Not that I don't think modern users would really ask the question, but it is, it's, you know, they gloss over that very, very thoroughly. And sometimes they go so far as to try to sort of give the appearance that it's a healthy and open environment, because they have, like, maybe they'll give you a scripting language, you know, to interact with their application under certain conditions. That's practically open source. If you have a scripting language, right? No, of course not. Maybe they give you an API. Well, that is practically open source. No, not really. It's just an API to interact with the application, as long as you continue to pay for it. So that's closed source stuff, and that's what they live by, and people still kind of seem to fail to see that. But this is why I think computer nerds especially are fond of Linux, because they are designed, open source is designed to be there for you no matter what. Any condition, it doesn't matter, Linux will have your back. I'm talking about, let's say there's some kind of problem with a computer, it's an emergency situation, I mean, not like emergency, like earthquake or emergency, but, you know, something very pressing, something's happening that needs to get done and something's wrong. You can download an ISO, an entire operating system, and boot the computer off of that thing, and you will have a working computer. You can download an ISO and boot it, have a working computer, and repair the system that that's on the hard drive. You can download the apps you need. They're all open source. They are free. You can open practically any format imaginable, except like the really, really closed ones, which, believe me, they exist. But it's designed so that if there's a problem, you can repair it quickly. Worst case scenario, you just download a new copy of your OS, download the application again, grab your file from whatever hard drive it exists on, and just run it in that temporary environment. I mean, there's no blockage there. There's nothing designed to get in your way. Whereas in closed source, again, that is exactly what closed source is doing. It is designed to put stuff in your way. You say, oh, I want this application. Well, there are ways to get any application that you want, but that's only because other people have jumped those hurdles. And certainly legally speaking, and since the programmers of those applications are asking for you to pay, and the companies are expecting you to pay, it's certainly very courteous not to steal the copies of that software. So yes, it would be nice to just license it properly. I wouldn't use that software at all, because their conditions of usage are just too unfriendly for me. I'm not going to sacrifice all the freedom and the assurance of data security that I would have to run such software. But there you go. The design of that software is to get into your way until you pay them and surrender a bunch of your rights and a bunch of the control over your data, and then you get to use it. Sometimes that's not very convenient. I speak from experience. There are times where something has gone wrong, all you want to do is get everything back up and running, and you find that all you're doing is maneuvering around all these blockades that were specifically designed to stop you from using the thing. I mean, it's insane. It's phenomenal. I have had so many bad experiences of that variety. I could go on and on. I mean, literally, a native operating system for a certain kind of brand of computer would not install on that brand of computer because just arbitrary decisions made by the vendor. It was aggravating beyond all belief, and it was under pressure, of course, because it always is. And if you're doing that kind of job and you know that open source exists and that Linux exists, something trips in your brain, you know, the tolerance level just goes way down. It's just like, it doesn't actually have to be this hard. Like, at one point you might have thought, yeah, this is what computers are. This is how hard computers are. It's it is difficult, and there's no, there, you know, not really a way around that. But I mean, the moment you see a Linux geek approach a broken computer, pop in a CD or a USB thumb drive, and reboot it, and suddenly have a working desktop just like that for free, and it took like, you know, 10 minutes, your whole perception changes. It's just, you can't imagine why on earth anyone would choose to use something that requires so much work just to be able to use it. Frankly, as I say it aloud, I'm still shocked that people actually do use anything but open source, but that's what they're used to, so there you go. So, the big thing for me about open source is the unrestricted understanding of computers that it offers. The difference between open source and restricted software is that open source, it does promote learning. It doesn't even have to vocally market the idea, you know. It just happens to promote it because everything is available to you. Everything's exposed to you. And if ever you find yourself asking, as you're doing something, gee, I wonder why it does that, then you can find out on open source. It's really not hard to find out exactly why something reacts a certain way. And usually, if you understand why, you're only that far from making it do something different. You might not be. I mean, it might be something so low level and beyond your understanding of how to actually implement it, but quite possibly it might be just, you know, one little thing that you have to do and suddenly everything is different for you. Very powerful stuff. And it doesn't mean that you have to learn code. You know, it could be, it can be small bits of information too, of education. You know, it can be, it can just be like random things like the, you know, MIME types like we talked about, I think, last episode. I mean, just that simple kind of little trick, or launchers, your own .desktop launchers, little things like that to a non, you know, someone who never wants to program, not interested in it, doesn't ever want to look at C code or C++ or even Python, you know? I mean, this is really simple stuff, and it's really, really empowering. Now, it's easier to adapt, I think, when there's not a deadline looming over you. I think it's harder to get started if you are, you know, prone to procrastination, and let's face it, who isn't? But it's a smoother ride in the long run. So if you're the type of person who is pondering, maybe I should try Linux, maybe I shouldn't, I think it's probably worth going in the direction of maybe you should try it. Especially because there's just no rush right now. You know, like maybe you're in a place where you don't have to get something done in an emergency situation. You can afford to just mess around with it. I mean, that's a great luxury to have, I think. I think that in the past, if I'd known about Linux, I would have been using it like way before I ended up actually using it. I mean, there was just, looking back and saying, okay, at this point I started Linux, and then back here is when I had like all of these horrible, disastrous computer problems, or my friend did and came to me for help and I couldn't help them. You know, I mean, there was like this big sort of dark ages period where it was just, had I only known then what I know now, that kind of thing. And Linux makes all that stuff possible. It really does. It protects you from all the, planned obsolescence of the closed source stuff. And it is designed to make things possible. That's a big deal in computing. It's a big deal in education. It's a big deal just in life. To have a tool that is designed to help you. I mean, designed specifically to never get in your way no matter what. And it doesn't feel like that initially. That's the problem, I think. It feels initially that while you're learning Linux, all it does is get in your way because everything's different, and so it must be Linux's fault. No, actually, it's not. It's just everything's different. And the more you learn, the more you realize that different is sometimes actually better. So if you have the luxury, I encourage you to start messing around with Linux today, now, before you find that you should have done it years ago. And I realize that not everyone has the ability, or rather the need, to learn, you know, everything about computers. That might not be your goal in life. But I think you'll find that if you start messing around with it, you'll start learning so much about computers and realize that just a little bit of understanding makes your experience with computers so much better that it's actually worth a look. So that's all I'm saying, is that it's worth a look, and it's definitely worth a look while you have the luxury to look at it calmly and peacefully, rather than when everything's going horribly wrong and all you need is to rescue something, and if only you knew a little bit more about Linux, maybe you could. So there you go. Those are my thoughts on I guess why I think Linux is worth bothering with, really. And it's hard not to judge it, you know, just on first impressions and kind of looking at it and saying, well, it's different, it must be bad. It's better. Different is actually better sometimes. So with that, let's go get a cup of coffee, and let's talk about thumbnailing and Synfig Studio. So thumbnailing. You know what thumbnailing is. I mean, it's a pretty common thing that file managers tend to do these days. You open up some window on your computer, and all the pictures are little tiny pictures of, you know, little tiny versions of the bigger versions. Maybe the movies have a little poster frame, and so on. So that's a handy feature, and it's something that Linux both does and does not. It's a lot more optional. It has more options in Linux, because in Linux, well, there are several users of Linux, obviously, and some people use Linux in such a way that the expense of going out to a server or a remote file system of some sort and then bringing back the data in order to generate that thumbnail would be bothersome. And so not all desktops have it turned on by default. Sometimes it's something that you can turn on and off at will. Lots of different varieties, so let's take a look at it and you can learn all the different options that you have on Linux. This is Noob Corner, by the way. I should have mentioned that. So if you're a noob, you're going to love this corner. Let's look.
Thumbnailing on most operating systems is something that just happens, and to some degree on Linux it just happens. Certainly on KDE, it just kind of assumes that that's a capability that you want. In Dolphin's case, which is what we're looking at here, on the screen if you're looking at the video, and if not, just imagine it on the audio, Dolphin window, top toolbar, you do have an icon, or you may have an icon, labeled Show Preview of Files and Folders. So if I click that, all of the graphics in this current folder are thumbnailed, and I get a little preview of the graphic within Dolphin. You can also configure this behavior, because if you are on a slower system, or if you just don't care about thumbnails, you may not want that to happen all the time, or you might want to configure what gets thumbnailed. And the way to do that is to go into the configuration menu of Dolphin, go down to Configure Dolphin, go all the way down to the General category, and in the General category panel, you should eventually see a Previews tab, and in the Previews tab there is a very long list of all the different types of files that you could possibly imagine that your system has the ability to generate thumbnails for. So, I mean, there's comic books, cursor files, desktop files, EXR images, folders, font files, HTML files, all kinds of different things, and it's really just up to you as to what exactly you want to see a preview for versus a generic icon. Obviously, the more that you preview, a little bit harder your system has to work in order to sort of show you a window. So if I get a new dolphin window up here, you can see, if you're looking at the video, you can see that some of the folders, some of the directories have overlaid on them a sample of what pictures are contained in that folder. And you should even see that the plain text documents, if we really look at them closely, you can see that they're actually being thumbnailed. So you can actually, even if you keep zooming in enough, you could actually read the text contained within these files, which may or may not be terribly useful to you. And to some degree, you might even find it a little bit annoying, because yes, you can read the subtle that'll confuse you, at a glance. You might not be able to really tell what kind of file that is. So it's really completely up to you whether something should or should not be thumbnailed. You have complete control over that, at least in Dolphin. Okay, so a couple of things to point out here. So if I do a search for, I'm just going to do a search for the word thumb, you can see that there are a couple of different thumbnailer applications, and in fact, the one that my system uses most often is InPlayer Thumbs. And InPlayer Thumbs is a video thumbnail generator for KDE file managers like Dolphin and Conqueror. So it can be used to show previews of images, preview images of video files. There's also an FFmpeg thumbnailer, there's a Thunar thumbnailer, there's a RAW thumbnailer, so that it will generate previews of RAW files, RAW images. So lots of different little thumbnail applications that you could potentially install on your system. And I'm going to guess that there's probably even more than that on other systems. So this one, for instance, is a Fedora system. Yeah, Fedora 20. So if I do a yum search for, let's just do thumbnail, there are probably quite a few things that you could look at for Fedora thumbnails or for any other system. So there are a couple of different, like, little plugins, basically, Krita thumbnail generator for GNOME, EPUB thumbnail generator for GNOME, FFmpeg thumbnailer again. So different things that you can just kind of look into. So if something's not getting thumbnailed on your system, have a look around. There might be something that enables your computer to make a thumbnail. And it might be something that you have to explicitly tell it, okay, thumbnail this file. It may just be something that taps into the rest of your system. It kind of depends. So let's look at a different thumbnailer, because obviously not all of them do everything the same way. This is Space FM. And if we look at the wallpaper thing again, you can see that this is clearly not generating thumbnails for these images. So in theory, this should be fairly simple to configure. Let's give it a shot. So first of all, I'm going to change my view to something a little bit larger, so we can actually see the thumbnails once we get them. So you can see, as I say, there's no thumbnails. And then if we go to View Preferences, we should be able to look around in here somewhere and find a preference for either the thumbnail generator program or just a preference to, here it is, do it. So show thumbnails. Now again, it's very configurable. It's a lot more configurable than probably what you're used to, so it will show thumbnails, but it gives you the option of saying, well, don't generate a thumbnail for a picture up to a certain size. So we'll raise that up a little bit, or actually a lot bit. This is in kilobytes, I just noticed, so let's just go crazy with it. Yeah, that's pretty good. So we'll say okay to that, and then as you can see, it generates the thumbnails and shows them to me pretty much automatically. And that should, I reckon, it should persist throughout all the different views, and it does. Okay, so that's a good example. So now let's go over to Thunar really quick. And this isn't actually a thumbnail issue, but it's related, or it will seem related to you. Now in this one, you can see that there are icons that are just flat out missing, and that's kind of weird. Now the reason for this, and this is again not a thumbnail issue, you can kind of go through and look at all the different options and preferences, but no matter what we do, there just aren't any icons at all, thumbnail or otherwise. Oh, actually there are thumbnails. That's kind of funny. So it's obviously automatically generating the thumbnails correctly, but it's not generating like directories and icons correctly. So this is just a little bonus tip for you if you use KDE. Because the KDE desktop does not configure GTK things, at least not automatically, if you go to System Settings in KDE and go down to GTK Styles, you kind of see most of the most popular configuration options, text and like the overall style. What it's not setting here is the icon theme. So if you go to your .gtkrc-2.0-kde4, at least that's what it's called today, and open that in an editor, you see that the theme has been defined as XFCE Dawn, which if you sneak a peek again over at my GTK settings for KDE, we see that that's what we set it to in my system settings. And then the font name is Droid Sans Fallback 9, and that's using just the default KDE font set. So that's correct, but what it is missing is a icon theme. And so that I don't get this wrong, I'm just going to import it from my cheat. And that is gtk-icon-theme-name equals whatever you want. So we'll set it to Oxygen for right now. And if I wasn't sure what themes I had available to me, I could do a list of user share icons. And here's all the different sets that I could use. So I'm using Oxygen with a lowercase o, and that does matter. And so then if we launch Thunar now, you can see that all the icons, or if you're not watching the video, you can imagine it, all the icons are now generated correctly.
So there you go, those are thumbnails on your Linux desktop. Now, we should talk about Synfig Studio, which is a really cool animation application. It is, it's a fairly complex application, and I would call it unintuitive. But that's not because of, it's not because of bad design or anything. It's simply that animation itself can be unintuitive. The basics of animation, like the flipbook style of animation where you have, a stack of paper and you draw a little stick figure and stick figure and stick figure, and then you flip it and it looks like the stick figure is moving because you're seeing the pictures rapidly. That's intuitive. We got that. That's also very labor intensive because you have to draw every single frame. So a lot of modern animators or animation programs are designed to kind of minimize that workload. And Synfig gives you that ability.
So when you first launch it, you've got your typical sort of canvas area, a toolbar, and an outliner, and a timeline, which if you've done any kind of animation or graphics before, you're probably fairly familiar with the concept. So the first thing I'll do is go down to Edit Preferences. I'll change the document size just a little bit larger. And of course you can set your frames per second, and a lot of animators know that there's, you know, the fewer frames you have to do per second, obviously the easier it is on you, because you have to draw less and configure less. But in this case, since I do want to sync it up to sound, presumably, I'm going to have to set it to either 24 or 25 frames per second, and I'll set it to 25 because that's the frame rate I've been using lately in all my different projects. And that's pretty much all we need to do for right now. The canvas is standard definition, which I'm only using because it means that the computer will have to think less. Animation itself, of course, is pretty basic in theory. I mean, the basics of it is simply making an object move from one position on the screen to another over the course of time. So I don't get the sense from Synfig, from the people over at Synfig making it, that they really expect you to do a whole lot of drawing in Synfig. I could be wrong, but that's kind of the feeling that I get. But I'm going to use some basic shapes just for this first part, just so that we kind of know the basic controls. So as you can see, when you create an object when you grab a shape tool from the toolbar, you can draw on the canvas just like any other program, but you get a lot more information than what you might be used to. So watch. So here I'm grabbing a square or a rectangle tool, and I'll just draw a sort of a background for my canvas, and I'll leave it as white. And we get in this outliner in the lower right-hand corner the fact that, yes, we've drawn a rectangle, and it's going to be called rectangle 012, because that's the first one, and I'm going to rename it to, I guess, background. If we get an arrow or a move tool, we can see a couple of attributes about this rectangle. In this case, all it really has going for it are nodes at each at two of the corners, the upper left and upper right corner, so we can resize with that. And then let's just do something really basic. We'll grab a circle tool, and we will draw a circle. And as you can see, you can't see the circle because it's also white. So here's the circle in our outliner, and the outliner is very much your friend in terms of trying to find where objects are, because a lot of times objects will be off screen or they'll be behind another object, and just looking at your canvas you won't be able to identify where things are, whereas in your outliner view, you can see where everything is. And that's a pretty standard practice for any kind of animation program, whether it's Synfig or Blender or anything else. So you got your outliner. We're going to call it, let's just call it a ball, because it'll bounce. And then we need to give this this a different color other than white, I think. Now, the couple of different ways you can do that in your tool palette, you can grab a paint bucket, just like you might be used to in any other program, and you can grab a different color, and then click inside the circle, and it will change the fill color to red, but you have to make sure that you're painting the fill region rather than the stroke region, which is something that Synfig differentiates pretty religiously, and it can get very confusing, as you could see, because if one color is in the fill box, then that's the color that's actually active, even though you think it's a different one. So the top color in your color swatch is the outline color, and the bottom one is fill. We don't have an outline yet. Okay, so there's our little circle. It's red, and it's sort of at the top of the screen right now. So as I said, animation basically is moving a shape from one place to another over the course of time. And if this is dealing with our shapes up here in our canvas, then the thing dealing with our time is our timeline at the bottom of the Synfig screen. It's always difficult, I think, to know exactly how fast things should move, but we'll just kind of eyeball it. So the thing about the timeline is that it's basically useless if you're not in animation mode or if you're not in recording mode. The way to do that is at the very bottom of your canvas area and at the top right of your timeline region, there's a button called, well, it looks like a little person, and he's green to start with. I think on some, if you've changed your icons around, it might just be a green circle. But it's a greenish button, and you can turn it. By default, you're not in animate mode. So if you click it, he becomes red, and the whole border of your canvas becomes red to remind you, hey, you're in animate mode. And at this point, everything that happens in the canvas is going to be recorded, essentially. Now, right now, nothing is recorded, so everything is just there, and it's not animatable, if you will. And usually what you do at the beginning of an animation is they call it jiggling. So you jiggle the object that you want to start animating, and that, as long as your little playhead in your timeline is at the beginning of your timeline, at the 0th frame, then now that you've sort of acknowledged this object's existence by clicking and moving it in my arrow tool, I have now set a keyframe on its position. And you can see what we've set exactly by looking on the left of your timeline. And you can see that the diamond-shaped keyframe that has appeared now that we've jiggled our object is next to the origin attribute. And the origin attribute is simply saying where is its origin point, and that's this big sort of green node in the middle of our object. That's the origin point. And right now it is on this Cartesian graph that is our canvas, located at -43/79. So that's the origin point, and that's the keyframe representing that. So now if we move our playhead forward a little bit, and we're counting in frames here, not in seconds. So if we go from 0 frames to, let's say, I don't know, let's 24 or 25 frames in a second. So let's, you know, if we go about to, let's say, 12-ish, that'll take half of a second. So let's do a little bit under 12. Let's do 9 frames. And in 9 frames, we want this ball to travel from here to the bottom of the screen, and then we'll move our playhead forward a little bit more to about, let's just go for 16 or so, and at that point, it'll bounce back up. And then we'll move a little bit more to, 23 or so, and we'll move it back down. And then another 9 or so, back up, another 9, back down. And we just kind of do this over and over until either we or our audience gets bored. Okay, so let's just assume that it's kind of settled at this point, the ball, I mean. And now we've got a pretty basic animation here. Now the first thing that we want to do, or the next thing that we want to do after we've, you know, once we're finished the animation itself, is get out of animate mode, because otherwise you'll do something wrong and you'll record that as part of your animation, and that's not what you probably want. So I'm just going to kind of scrub through here, and as you can see, it kind of bounces up and down. Probably not completely accurate in terms of physics, but roughly, yeah, that's what's supposed to happen. So if I'm gonna go back to the beginning of the timeline here, and I'll hit the play button, and we can see kind of a rough little preview of what we've animated. So pretty simple. Now that's the super basics of this. So let's do something a little bit more interesting. And instead of animating this little circle, let's make a really quick title sequence for ourselves. We don't like red. We'll go back to black. And we'll get some text, maybe. I would say text is probably where SynFig sort of hurts the most. Not that it can't do it, it's just that it doesn't have a great text interface. So if you want to do text, just get ready for a lot of fudging around in really obscure text entry boxes, And we've got our New World Order title here. You can change the font, but as I say, the font, or the whole text interface in Synfig is still very much in works. Because as you can see, yes, you can change font family. You have to just type in manually the font name. So if you don't know, you know, all of your fonts by heart, you had better get to know them pretty well. And the way that I look at them, I mean, aside from just knowing my favorite ones, I just do a ls on /.local/share/fonts. That's got all of my different fonts in it, so I can look at what I have available. The other way, of course, would just be to look at them in your font manager or your font installer, like in Dolphin. But yeah, there's a bunch of different fonts on your system probably. Just go find out their names, and then you can type them in and actually use them. And that's something that they're working on. So okay, so we've got GNU World Order now. And what do we want it to do? I guess we'll have it. Well, let's just have it fade and blur in. That'll be good. So we've got text here, and once again, just like every other object, there's an origin point, so that's that green node right smack dab in the middle of the thing, and then there's a resize node, which is this sort of orangey looking one, and as you can see, it's kind of positioned at this imaginary kind of upper right corner, and if I stretch it out or stretch it up, then I'm stretching the actual text. So that's not always something that you want to do quickly, because it doesn't have any kind of constraint. Much easier possibly adjust the size in the parameters of the object itself. Over here on the left of the timeline, you can see that not only do you have the font family, but you also have like the size of the font. So you edit that manually and suddenly it changes, and you can just kind of lock it into certain aspect ratios and things like that. So I find a lot of the work that I do in general really are in like attributes and layer or outliners and stuff like that. And again, that's actually not that uncommon for animation programs. Blender, you kind of do the same thing. And quite a few animation programs, you do that. Okay, so here we go. That's the title of our show. And the first thing that we could do, I guess, is apply a blur to this thing. So the way that effects work in Synfig is that you create layers. And we don't usually think of effects as layers, so that's something that's a little bit unique. But if I go over to my outliner on the right-hand side of the screen, and I right-click on my title object, go up to New Layer, and then I find a blur, and here's a blur layer. Now, the blur layer, by the way that this works is it cascades. So technically speaking right now, although you don't actually see it, but technically this blur is affecting this background. And I can kind of prove that to you, I hope, by, we'll do a Synfig tutorial text object. So I'm making this other text object, and as you can see, this second text object that I've just now created is very much blurred as well. So this blur layer is affecting everything underneath it. So how can you possibly use these layers? Well, the answer is that you encapsulate them. So if I select both the blur and the GNU title, and then right-click on either of them and group layer, now I've got a layer group. And I'll call this GNU title group. So now, as you can see, the blur layer is only working on the objects within its group. Now if I moved the title above the blur object in the group, oops, I didn't mean to move it out of the group, if I move it below the blur object, then it no longer has an effect on that. So it is very much a cascading effect. So in this group, I will say that this blur object is above the GNU title, and then it gets cut off once we leave the group, and so it doesn't affect the Synfig tutorial. Now, I think what we'll do, though, is we'll make another group for my second title phrase. We'll go ahead and add a blur object onto it as well. And that way we'll have two different blurs going on, and they'll both be independently controllable. Okay, so the first thing that we'll do, I guess, is we'll position the GNU World Order phrase over to the left of the canvas, and we'll position the synfig title phrase over on the right. Two titles kind of on the very extremes, opposite extremes of the canvas, and we haven't animated them yet, so that's just kind of where they are. And now it's just a question of animating each different attribute over time. So I guess it's probably safe to go into animation mode now, so I'll click my animate editing button, and you can see the red border, or you can imagine it if you're not watching the video. Red border around our canvas shows up, telling us, hey, you're in animation mode, so anything you do is going to be recorded. So the first thing we'll do is kind of give our titles a bit of a jiggle here, just to set their starting position. And there we go. Our starting positions have been recorded, and you can see that in your timeline with that little diamond keyframe shape. And now we'll set our blur. So the blur, what we actually want, I think, is a lot of blur to begin with. So I'm going to set it to, not 2, apparently, to 1. How about 1.4? That's still too much. Okay, so 1 is the maximum value, I guess. It's not quite as much of a blur as I had kind of wanted, but I guess that'll do. We could play around with the other blur types, but I'm not quite that committed to this example to do that. So I think both of the blurs are fine. And now, as you can see, just from me editing it, it has set a keyframe, and that's good. That's what you want. You want everything to be set at the beginning so that everything knows how it's supposed to come on screen, looking a certain way. So I think this is a good starter point, except that I really want my titles to fade in. And the way that we do that is there should be an alpha mode or a color mode or something. So what we'll do first is set the color of the text itself, of the GNU title. We'll set that, the alpha channel will set all the way to 0, meaning that it's invisible. And I'm going to do the same thing with my synfig object. So again, I'm just kind of, just notice how much I'm working in the outliner. It's really, it kind of, I think it confuses a lot of people when they're doing these kinds of programs that you're not actually clicking and dragging in the canvas that much. You're really working a lot in the outliner. And you might be surprised at how common that is in a lot of animation programs. Not so much the hand-drawn stuff, but the things where you're doing either 3D or just like motion graphics. It's a lot of outliner clicking. Okay, so we've got our blurs at maximum, we've got our alpha channels at minimum, so everything's transparent, and our titles are pretty much positioned where we want them. So now we will kind of move in, let's say, we kind of want this to be slow and graceful, so we'll go all the way up to 24 frames, so about a second. And by then, let's say that the GNU World Order title has been alpha'd all the way up to solid, so 100% alpha. And we also want it to have moved into its final position. And we also, of course, want our blur to be down at 0% by this time. So it's completely solid, it's taken form. So we can just kind of review that quickly. That's pretty good. We may want our blur to finish, you know, later, because I think by the time we actually see the thing, the blur has already basically faded away. So we can do that in the timeline. So we have our keyframes. We know that this keyframe over here at 0 frames represents a solid, you know, 100% blur, maximum blur. And this one represents no blur. So what we can do is we can move the no blur value out another 12 frames or so, and the solid blur up a bit. So it's going to just remain completely blurry. And then we get out of blur mode. And I think that's what we really want. So that's kind of how you can work in the timeline a little bit as well. Alright, so now we'll do the synfig title. And it's basically the same process. So we want that to come in a little bit. We want the GNU World Order to come in first, but we don't want to wait till it's completely solid and settled before we get to synfig. So we'll grab the synfig beginning keyframe and put it at, I guess I'm at 18 frames right now, and then we'll have it completely visible about the same time that GNU World Order is coming out of its blur mode. And to make it visible, of course, we just position our playhead at whatever frame count, so it's 30, and then click on the color attribute, and we'll make its alpha channel 100%, so that it's completely solid. But remember, it's also completely blurred right now. I think, once again, I think a little bit of little staggering of the keyframes is probably a good idea. I don't think we want everything to sort of come into sort of realize itself all at the same time, because then it looks very kind of stinted and scripted and not very graceful. So a little bit of unevenness is good. So then after, let's say, it's completely solid and now it's settled, we probably want its blur value. So in the outliner, I'll click the blur value again. We probably want the blur to... I don't think I keyframed the blur there. Where did I keyframe the blur? That's okay, though. We can do that manually here. So if you remember how to do the keyframing of the blur, all we did, really, since we can't physically jiggle it, we can kind of jiggle it manually by just typing in 1 again and hitting return. And it marks it so that it's blurry. At this point, it's still maximum blur, and then I guess right about here, when it stops, you know, it's visible, but it's still moving. So let's have it sort of solidify itself right about at 40 frames. So again, we're in animation mode, so anything we do will be recorded. So as long as our playhead is where we want it to come out of its blur, and we type 0 and hit return, then the blur should, you know, now it's keyframed, and you can kind of see it coming into its solid form there. Okay, so that's a pretty good little intro, I think. I think maybe the motion's a little bit off on the synfig title. Once again, we'll just kind of leave it like this for now, just for brevity. Okay, so speaking of brevity, I should probably save. One of the nice things about the synfig project files is that they all zip themselves up into a self-contained little package, so you don't really have to worry about keeping your assets together or anything. Everything pretty much gets bundled up into a .sifz package. Okay, so we're basically done here, as done as we can be. So we will set out to render this then. The rendering button is on along the top toolbar of the canvas area, and the before you render, you should look at your settings, and that's also a button up there, but it's also in canvas, I think. Yeah, it's either in edit preferences or canvas something, canvas properties. So we see that we've got some, you know, we set our canvas and everything pretty small to begin with. It looks like it's an edit preferences. That's the one I'm looking for. If you recall, we had it 720 by 480. But the cool thing about synfig is that it's completely vector-based, so it's kind of like Inkscape. That means you can actually go out to whatever canvas size that you want to go out to. So in the render, when you click render settings, you can configure where everything's going to get dumped out to, which is kind of nice. So there's a couple of different ways to do this. Of course, you can send all of your... You can render out into into a sequence of images, which I would say is probably most traditional. But you could, if you've got everything installed correctly, you could actually, you can have Synfig pipe itself into FFmpeg and end up with an actual movie. No, I don't think I will do that, actually. I think I'll save it as a PNG so I can use this in the episode. So I'm going to leave it as a PNG sequence. I'm going to turn the quality all the way up to 9. Unfortunately, it does not go all the way up to 11. And then anti-aliasing up to 31. That seems pretty arbitrary as well, but whatever. Yeah, so we'll keep that. Now, there is a question, I guess, of alpha. Really, what I could do is leave the background out. I could render it out, and then I would have no background, and that way I could put it over, you know, me talking or any background that I wanted. In real life, I'm not going to do that, so I'm going to leave this nice sort of gray background on it. But do be aware that you can you don't have to. It doesn't have to be solid. You can animate stuff and have it, like, you know, swing in over your footage, and it'll work just fine. So that's kind of cool. So we'll just increase the canvas size. The time, we actually don't need as much time as we had allotted to begin with. I do know that I want 25 frames per second. I want to start at 0 frames. The end frame, really, I mean, I think the latest frame we have is about 40, but we want to give ourselves a little bit of time to linger on the titles, so let's go all the way up to 72. Which really is not a lot of time at all still. So we'll do that. We've set our destination, and then we'll render. And that's basically Synfig. We'll let that render. Really quickly, I'm gonna emphasize, I guess, that they do not appear to want people to draw, or they don't intend for people to draw, I don't think, in Synfig. The tools just aren't really that flexible. They're very kind of, you know, here's some shapes. You can draw in Synfig. It is totally possible. It's just not super optimized for being a drawing place. And even their tutorials, they never really highlight the ability to do drawing within Synfig. It seems to be a common practice to import stuff from other applications. The one thing you should be aware of is that when you do import things from other applications, and certainly one of the things that I think is the most common to import from would be Inkscape, because that way you get to draw in vector, and then you get to to stay in vector. You never lose quality throughout the whole thing. So when you import something from Inkscape, rather, then you have usually a lot of things. So here's a little tutorial educational graphic that I did in Inkscape. And if we wanted to animate it, you can see that a straight import of it gives us well over 1,000 unique objects in this, and that's just insane. You don't want to have to deal with that in your outliner, and you don't want to make your computer have to deal with all that. So the thing that I think you end up doing instead is, well, in Inkscape, group things together as much as you can, and then once you bring it in, make sure that you go through and group things together that are logically grouped. So you have star clusters, you have a planet with lots of different layers, but you group it into one thing. You have a spaceman grouped into one object. And that way, when you go to do all of your different animations on the objects, you're not trying to select each different object with lots of different points and things like that. So, yeah, it helps to kind of group things together before, and then group them even more afterwards, so that you can just grab onto whole groups of things. So, that's just a brief note. So let's see if our render is done. I think it should be, and we'll look at what we did. I think overall that looks pretty good. I'm happy with it. Two resources that I would be remiss to leave out, of course, would be where you can find out more information. I have to say, of all the projects I've encountered, Synfig, I mean, it's a complex application, but they're really great in terms of offering tutorials. So one place that you can look, of course, for a quick start is Slacker Media, slackermedia.info. Go to the handbook link, and then along the left side of the screen, or I think the bottom if it's on a mobile, you can find applications and quick starts. There are lots of different quick starts here, but one of them is indeed Synfig. It's in text, so you can follow along. So consider these my show notes. That's a pretty good show note. So that's Slacker Media. The other one is straight from Synfig, and the earlier one I purchased, I've not purchased the latest one, but they're really, really good. It's the Synfig training courses. You can't go wrong. It's really, really solid little program on how to use this really, really nice application. So check that out. It's well worth it. And of course, all the money, I mean, it was completely produced by the Synfig programmers and that team. So it's worth doing. Apparently there's a Udemy.com course as well. So you can sign up for that and get even more. So there you go. Very, very highly recommended.
So that's a lot of fun. I've used Synfig for all kinds of projects. I don't really draw very well myself, so it's not like I do a whole lot with it, but especially for like motion graphics and stuff, it's a really handy tool to know. So you should play around with it if you've got any need for that sort of thing, especially now that you have a little bit of a better understanding about it. That's about it for this show, so I'll talk to you next time.
Okay, I think that's it for this episode. Thank you very much for listening, as always. My name is Klaatu. You can find me online at GNUWorldOrder.info or at SlackerMedia.info. You can find me via email at Klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And you can also find me on linuxquestions.org as NotKlaatu. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.
His hands were dirty, and his hair was messy.